live from the Findlay Toyota Studios, it's Cofield and Company on ESPN Las Vegas.
Ah, damn it. Major cities on the Mississippi River. New Orleans, Memphis, St. Louis, Baton Rouge, Minneapolis. Oh, man, I blew that one. And geography, Midwest geography, not my strong suit. 5 o'clock hours here, we were just talking about the Vikings, and we made a west of the Mississippi reference. I tried to tie in Minneapolis with San Francisco. I blew it. Paul Gutierrez knows that the Bay Area is way west of the Mississippi. He is a Raiders insider. Paul joins us here for this hour of Cofield and Company. What's up, buddy?
What's going on, Steve? Long time no see. It's like, you know, if The Rock was here, he'd say, finally, Paul G is back with Cofield and Company or something like that.
Did you know that Minneapolis is on the river?
You know, it's one of those things where I didn't know, but I knew after being told and I forgot. But yeah, I remembered it as soon as you said it. You don't think of it that way. St. Louis, definitely, because I remember the opening scene of Vacation when Clark W. Griswold is crossing and he's singing the Mighty Mississippi. So
Give me the road report first, and Paul's going to be on Cofield and Company often, so we're going to hear about the road and food and stuff like that, stuff we love. Have you been to Seattle a bunch of times? So what's your impression? What was it like this time?
Love Seattle as a city. And shockingly, it was about 65 degrees and overcast and drizzling. So that's Seattle for you. But, now that being with the team and staying at the team hotel and everything, I mean, I guess you could say my highlight of that trip was really just kind of being on the elliptical right next to Mark Davis as he was getting his sweat on as well, working out at the hotel gym and just kind of, you know, saying hello, how are things going, yada, yada. But I had seen him the week prior in Canton as well, so caught up a little bit there at the Hall of Fame. But Seattle itself is just a phenomenal city. One of my best friends from high school at Barstow, he's been up there working for Boeing since 1991. So he went up there a Dodger fan, now he's a Mariner fan. He went up there a Washington football team fan, now he's a Seahawk fan. But there's something really cool and clean about Seattle that I really, really like. The traffic there is brutal. I mean, it really makes Las Vegas travel traffic look like nothing. So getting from the team hotel in Bellevue down to the stadium, it's about a 12-mile drive in normal traffic. It'll take about 15 minutes. It took us an hour and 20 minutes. And I drove down there with Jason Horowitz and Kirk Morrison because the Mariners had just played a game next door and they had a walk-off in extra innings. So traffic was just brutal. I'm sure nobody really listening really cares about that for us, you know, all the behind the scenes things, but yeah, I mean, Seattle's a cool city unless you need to be somewhere in a hurry.
I'm sure there's quite a few people listening to your comment about Barstow a couple of seconds ago.
Yeah.
That makes two success stories out of Barstow. That's a pretty big upset.
Who are the two? You, not count.
You, you and your buddy.
Which
actually,
one?
And I've told you, I know other I know other people from Barstow who turned out pretty good. So,
Dino Ebel, third base coach for the Dodgers. Barstow High School class of 1984, 4 years ahead of me. And we used to play softball together back in the day and growing up in Barstow. Dino was the man. He was the dude. His parents had an Italian restaurant, La Scala Italian restaurant there on Main Street. And, you know, what you do in small towns, you cruise up and down. And there was Dino always just hanging out in front of his parents' restaurant, just hanging out.
Nice.
Waiting to go to spring training with the Dodgers is who he signed with coming out of college. So, yeah, Dino's from Barstow. See him all the time. He's married. His wife is somebody I graduated with. So, small town, cool. A lot of pride in that.
MD is 70 now or 69? Mark Davis. I think he's 70. So nice work on the elliptical. I'm impressed by that. I don't know that Paul can hear us right now. I think he's trying to get that in line. Paul, you got us? We'll get him here in a second. But there is a reason. I didn't know MD Mark Davis works out on the elliptical. There is a reason that he is a dude who can actually still wear the white pants, the white jacket. Because you can't be lumpy. You can't be lumpy and bumpy trying to wear the white. And I'm impressed by MD. So, all right, I want to get into this. And Paul's going to give us his take on this. If you missed the beginning of the show, I know it's a few days removed. Although the comments from Pete Carroll, I think, were yesterday about Geno and the middle finger. On Thursday, apparently there was a sign. in reading what that sign said, unless there was a different sign, it didn't seem that insulting to me. I'm also pretty thick-skinned, and maybe there's some emotion walking into Seattle and feeling like, hey, they bailed on me and Geno Smith. But to fire the double bird, I thought was a little overboard. And then Pete Carroll came over the top, and I think it was Tashaun Reed who was asking the question about the obscenity. And Pete paused for a second, and he's like, did you see the sign? Next question. Well, I saw the sign. I think Paul can hear us again. I saw the sign. Now we can't hear Paul. I saw the sign, and it said bigger bust, Geno or Jamarcus Russell. That sign is so laughable, I don't know that I could get mad at it. Like I think I could just brush it off. But I'm not the guy who just left Seattle and Geno Smith.
Yeah, can you hear me?
I can, yeah.
All right, there you go. Yeah, so I heard you, and I wasn't down on the field when it happened, but in talking to people that were around the situation when it happened,
yeah.
It was a weird thing where I guess this fan that had the sign is kind of known for being somebody that gets under the skin of opposing fans, teams when they come through. It's kind of like, I can't remember the guy's name, but remember he was a Washington Bullets fan back in the day, yeah, who purposely sat right behind the benches of the visiting teams, and he'd go off and he'd do his homework. So my understanding is that it was somebody like that. And the sign in and of itself, like you said, I mean, it's laughable, but it also, like somebody tweeted at me, look at Jamarcus out here catching strays. He had absolutely nothing to do with this. And, even Pete Carroll, what made that even better was Pete saying next question, then looking away from, it was actually Ryan McFadden, I believe, that asked the question.
Oh, it was. Okay.
The whole thing is just strange. And it's funny because when you watch the live video of when it happened, it happens in an iFlash, right? But whoever was there on the camera, I mean, it's a pretty iconic shot, especially the one from behind. But then when you see Pete Carroll, you see Pete Carroll off to the side, and he's kind of looking like, what's going on? And then Max Crosby decides to join in because he's going to ride or die with his quarterback. It just sets up a kind of a scene there that for fans and for anybody else that was watching thinking, okay, what in the world is happening here?
Do you think Pete did the next question thing as kind of another opening salvo here to say, you know what, guys, no matter almost whatever you do, I'm going to have your back?
It can be interpreted that way, no doubt, especially in that locker room. Because when you hear, when you see it, and you see the video of the way Pete, the way he said it and the way he kind of just looked away, I mean, it basically tells the players, yeah, I got your back, and ride or die or whatever. It's something that kind of goes along with it. And then when you see the video of today's practice and he's shooting double leg takedowns on Deuce Gruden before practice out there, it just, again, it kind of shows what kind of atmosphere and culture that Pete is building with the Raiders. Doesn't mean it's going to translate to wins or anything, but it helps for a healthy locker room and a healthy culture.
I feel like Deuce would be more susceptible to a single. I think a double with the size of his legs and his height, I don't think you're getting him down.
I'm just thinking, I wrestled in high school too, and I'm just thinking, how come Deuce isn't sprawling? He kind of gave it up.
Did he go down?
He just totally gave it up. He went down.
Oh,
totally
come on. All right, Pete.
But our guy Levi Edwards tweeted out the video, so I responded with a couple of things. I said, you got to shoot, and you got to sprawl. And not only that, but being somebody that just loves the movie Vision Quest, I'm thinking, shoot? You want to wrestle, shoot? No, it was interesting.
Going back to the Geno thing for a second, I guess I haven't really asked anyone or thought of the notion that, does Geno feel hurt that he was moved by Seattle? Is there emotion there? I mean, they offered him a big deal. He couldn't come to terms with him. They moved on him. Is he mad?
He hasn't spoken on that yet, but there's obviously something there. And Jamal Adams kind of spoke on it from his own perspective, that not about Geno's situation, but he wanted to prove something to Pete Carroll because he goes, look, they cut me. I got something to prove to Pete too. And these guys, the athletes, these elite athletes, they always have to have something driving them, right? So it would not shock me whatsoever if Geno Smith did have something. And like, lo and behold, there you go. You're going back and you're starting for a new team in the same city you had just done things for. It's I don't know if hurt is the right feeling there, but there's definitely some feelings because you wouldn't be human if you didn't. Now, it's just a simple matter of how do you harbor those feelings? What do you do with them? What kind of energy do you spend with it? Because as we saw in that video that came out over the summer too, when he was coaching that Little League football game in Miami, this reminds you, he's still got some South Florida in him. Oh, yeah. When he said, you know, that's why they pay me the big bucks. So you know, it's right under there. He's a pro's pro, though, when he's talking with the media and when he's telling his stories. And, you know, in the pregame the day before, I got to sit in on the production meeting with him. And just a very intriguing character and backstory. This is a guy that went to high school and was like art. He's like an accomplished artist. So there's something that's going on there that's making him tick as well.
You know, it's interesting. If we go back, and Paul Gutierrez is sitting in this hour with Cofield and Company. If we go back a couple of months ago, a lot of Raiders fans were like, man, look at all this cap room. And they wanted some big ticket items. Raiders didn't do that. But what they've done is they're kind of mining the veteran market. And some of the names they've brought in are, you know, formerly big names. And, you know, they were without a job. And the surprising thing with a lot of them is sometimes you drop off in the NFL, you might only be 27, 28 years old. Now, Jamal Adams is coming up on 30. This signing is really interesting. One, how do you think they're going to use him? Because it sounds like he's not going to be playing a lot of safety, but, you know, another linebacker. Because I, again, it's preseason. I'm not going to go crazy.
Yeah.
I thought his debut at times was spectacular. His energy, talking on the field, like he can be a real player. And he was, for his position, he was a good sack guy in the past.
They've moved him to the Will linebacker, the weak side linebacker spot. So they want him to rush the passer. They want him to be able to cover some guys out in the flat. He's not your prototypical big linebacker. He was a safety in his previous life, so to speak. But it's interesting. We talked to him at the podium over the weekend, and he was asked specifically about the position switch. And he said, look, when Pete Carroll came to him and said, hey, we want to sign you. You're going to play linebacker. That's it. So Jamal said, oh, okay, I guess that's what we're going to do. Let's go. So you saw that energy. And again, he was amped up because just the way the NFL scheduling gods, even the preseason scheduling gods played with it, of course he's going to go open up in Seattle where he had a very ugly, ugly divorce from, right? So if he can stay in that headspace, stay in that controlled headspace, and more important than that probably, stay physically healthy, this is a guy that, as he described it, his patella tendon came right off of his kneecap. So he had to learn. He said he learned a lot about himself. And I asked him, well, what exactly did you learn about yourself? And it was just having to learn that patience and to be able to lead from ahead rather than from behind. And when you listen to his interview during the game, you listen to him at the podium that day, very, very impressive the way that he's looking at things in his life now, especially in the career. So if they get that energy and he stays healthy, I mean, they've got a leader and they've got a guy, really, like you said, they're mining for guys that are looking for second chances. And isn't that really it's in the Raiders' DNA anyways?
Yep.
And then he has that trust in Pete Carroll that Pete Carroll, again, like we talked about earlier, I mean, he's out there. I've described him as he's just perpetually effervescent, you know, because he's just always this positive guy. And if they're able to see that and that translates into positive things on the field, which then would translate into wins, that's what they're going for. So when you look at what they're trying to do, they have a lot of young guys, and especially at linebacker and with Jamal Adams, a lot of older guys that are still looking to be reborn, rejuvenated. Devin White is another person, case in point.
Well, in the case of Adams, he sort of couldn't win in Seattle because, one, the deal they made was insane. It was way too much capital to give up for him. And then he has an injury. I think I can't remember if it was the end of the Jets or in Seattle. He had some tiff with a media member, which, by the way, highly advise don't do that. and those fans are crazy up there. Speaking of that, and I want you to react to Adams and kind of, you know, well, first, react to that. Like he kind of had a rough go in Seattle where he only had 1 year where he really got to show his wares.
He's only played, Steve, I did the math on this, not a big deal here, but in the past three NFL seasons combined, he's played a combined 16 games. Huh. He's basically missed two full seasons based on injuries. So when you have these ugly, acrimonious exits, whether it's in New York, which is the media capital of the world, and then Seattle, you know, it helps you. And that's what I think he was referring to, is that he learned a lot about himself and how to handle certain situations, how to still have this. It's a contained fury. I think he plays on the field with a contained fury. And if you're able to do that and do positive things out of that, that's where you're going to go. Now, there was a lot of bad mouthing on him on the Seahawks radio pregame show going on beforehand. So
yeah.
You know, I was kind of stunned to hear the things they were saying about him. But hey, I covered the A's way back when, in 2006, when Frank Thomas came to the A's. He actually won our Good Guy Award that year from the media members. It was like he was the best guy to work with. The Chicago White Sox beat writers couldn't believe it. They're like, this guy was the cantankerous. He was this. He was that. He was the other. Yeah. What happened? I'm like, well, a lot of guys just simply need a change of scenery. I'm not saying Jamal Adams is Frank Thomas, the big hurt, but it's a similar situation. And again, that was almost 20 years ago.
Yeah, Jamal Adams had it out with Connor Hughes, and I think he commented on Connor's wife's appearance. I was like, okay, now we're going down a path that ain't a great path. Now, back to Seattle, one last point on the Seahawks. I mock on the 12s and kind of how dorky they are. They are good fans, though. Paul, I was vested in the end of the game on the final attempt to kick the field goal because we had a friend who had a four-team parlay going. He needed the Seahawks to win outright or push. That crowd, I mean, how much of the crowd was still there at the end of the game?
It was about 70% full still.
Holy
at the end.
Crap.
You got to say, and that place is loud. And then whether they pump music or crowd noise or whatever in there, it is loud regardless. And they you know, and the fact, again, like I said earlier, this the Mariners had just played literally across the street. So you had a lot of that. I'm sure there was a crowd that said, hey, let's have a doubleheader and come over to the football game too. And so that's a long day for the Seattle sports fans. And if you do have something riding on it, you know, whether it's for entertainment purposes only or if, like you said, your friend, there was something in it. And especially for Pete Carroll to be able to go back there and try to get the win. And, you know, it just kind of like went, eh, it just ended with a thud because of the way they blocked the field goal, right? But, yeah, I mean, there was a lot of people there that were still into it. And it made what had been a very boring and ugly game, especially in the first half, it made it exciting at the end. Because if you talk to any of those 180 players on both teams' rosters, anytime you take the field, you want to win a game. So to end there with a tie, you take it for what it is.
We didn't get to see Sam Darnold, right, at all?
No, but I was seeing ghosts. I was seeing ghosts out there because I was on the radio pregame show with Lincoln Kennedy and Q Myers. And I said, yeah, I'm sitting here and I'm seeing the ghost of Bo Jackson run this way, 91 yards. I'm seeing Josh Jacobs run 80-plus yards right. The other way. And I see Lincoln Kennedy pancaking linemen when he was at the University of Washington up the road a little bit. But, no, we didn't see Sam Darnold, and I tried to make that connection. No, it was none of the Seahawks starters really played, which is what was part of the concerning part from the Raiders, was that their number one defense pretty much got carved up in the first drive anyway. And then their number one offense couldn't get anything going. So those were the concerns, and those were the points of emphasis from the defensive side of the ball, tackling. And not just tackling, wrapping and tackling, because there was a lot of broken tackles on the side of the Seahawks. And yet, from the Raider perspective, as Pete Carroll himself said, well, that's what you kind of expect from a team that's literally starting from scratch and trying to build a new culture and everything. But then you're like, well, these guys are also paid professionals. And if you go over to practice on Sunday, sure, as I wrote in my column after the game, was that tackling was going to have to be an emphasis this week. Sure enough, off to the side, hitting the tackling sleds, they were actually doing the wrap. They were hitting and wrapping under the watchful eyes of Patrick Graham, the defensive coordinator. So that tells me they were definitely going back to basics on that day.
Yeah, are there limitations in practice in terms of how much you can tackle?
Oh, sure. There's a lot of rules in place now, and very rarely do you see them say it's going live.
Right.
It's funny. Like, I was watching the Bills Hard Knocks last night, and they said, okay, it's live. And they're still not drilling people and taking them all the way down to the ground, which is what they're trying to do to make themselves – you know, step pop on film in these games. And that's the dangerous part. If you're a starter and you're playing against a second or a third stringer from the other team that's trying to make the team, what better way to do that than to light up a starting player from another team? So that's the balance that they're trying to do here. In practice, it's kind of the same, because if you're a fringe roster guy trying to make the roster, are you going to go out there and try to show off against Max Crosby? Are you going to go out there and try and stuff Ashton Jeanty? You know, it's a very fine line and a very delicate dance. So very rarely do you ever see tackling to the ground. You hear a lot of popping,
yeah.
Not a lot of rapping and taking to the ground.
I often talk to Griffin about this because Griffin played defense at Utah and Cal Poly and a little bit for UNLV. And I talk about UNLV practices on the lack of tackling. Now, they've had two live scrimmages where they tackled. But I get the sense during practice, the defense is like, this sucks. They're being driven over the edge. I told a story on the air last week that Alex Orji had a day where they were running red zone, and Orji was really effective. I mean, he's 6'3", 235, the Michigan transfer. He can run the ball. And when you get him in close space, you know, and then you hit him. So he was kind of lighting up the defense, and practice was about to end. And Paul Gunther, you know, who you know well, was the Raiders DC for a while. Gunther was kind of like, let's do one more. How about we take the black jersey off? Like, he was like so frustrated that his defense wasn't stopping him. It's like, well, it's hard in practice when you can't freaking light up the skill players.
And that's the other thing from the reverse perspective here. Throughout offseason OTAs and mandatory minicamp and the first couple days of regular training camp, it was actually more of an advantage for the defense because the offensive line couldn't do anything. So they couldn't hit, they couldn't knock guys around. So that's why you saw Max Crosby, who's going to get what he's going to get anyway. Yeah, yeah. But you saw the defensive guys are just literally running circles around the offensive tackles and the guards because they couldn't hit them. So at the NFL level, at least with the Raiders, it was the exact opposite because they couldn't. The offensive line couldn't hit anybody. And then it just kind of goes back and forth from there. And then you also have to remember, well, if whichever session you're watching, is it an offensive period? Is it a defensive period?
Yep.
You very rarely get to see it. Okay, when they say it's live, quote unquote live, that's when it's okay, now we're going skill on skill and we'll see what happens. But you're never going to see them drill Ashton Jeanty or knock Brock Bowers running a slant across the middle to the ground. You know, so you got to take care of your stars that way too.
Westgate Superbook has the only college football contest in Vegas, 100% payback, and top 10 winners are getting paid each week. You guys, if you go on the contest, you pick 7 college football games against the contest line. Entry fee is $500. You want to put in 10 entries, you can do it. They're taking entries until August 29th at 3 o'clock. The actual competition, you can get games in as early as August 27th. So get in, Westgate College Football Super Contest. And a reminder, JVT is back and better than ever, as he'll be doing 2 shows on the weekends. He'll be doing his traditional JVT Sunday football preview show at Westgate, 8 to 9 in the Superbook. That's building up the Super Contest in each week of the NFL. And with a college contest now, he'll also be out there. Very original name, JVT's Saturday football preview show at Westgate. Again, 8 to 9, back in that college football Super Contest, and he'll get you ready for all the college football of the day. Last couple minutes here before we take the middle of the hour break. The O-line is a big story. Right now they're trying to make some moves here. I'll give you some comments from some of the listeners and content creators on the way back, but give me your general take on what happened in the brief look that we got from this new look offensive line in that Seattle game.
Knee-jerk reaction is they got beaten up. They got moved around. They couldn't open any holes. The fact that your number one draft pick, the top running back of the draft class, runs for negative yardage in his NFL debut, granted it's a small sample size in the preseason, that can't be a good thing. I talked to Lincoln Kennedy about it on our podcast, Upon Further Review, at Raiders.com, and he was of the same mind. This is an all-pro tackle. And he said, well, that's kind of to be expected. But yet you got to take it personal too. So they got beat up a little bit there. And then also the most intriguing part there to me was the fact that while the rest of the starting offensive line took basically after that first series off, Jordan Meredith at center and right guard Jackson Powers Johnson, who everybody thought was going to be the starting center, they played together with different combinations on that line well into the third quarter.
Wow.
Which tells me that they're trying to figure out exactly who is a better fit where. Because that's the other thing about it. A lot of fans don't realize, and I know it sounds like I'm kind of talking in circles here, but it's not simply about who's the best left tackle, who's the best left guard, who's the best center, who's the best. It's about who gels the best together as a line. So if they've already decided that, well, Jordan Meredith is the best center and that Jackson Powers Johnson is going to be your starting right guard, you got to figure out who can fit in around them or where they fit in with the rest of the line. And it makes a lot of people scratch their head because all offseason, all we ever heard was that JPJ was going to be the number one center. I mean, you saw it. He went and introduced himself to Ashton Jeanty as, hi, I'm Jackson. I'm your new center.
Yeah.
So that makes a lot of people scratch their heads.
Comments from some fans, content creators. Someone said, I don't understand the idea of having speed at center. What about power? And then a person named a bunch of power centers. I saw another commenter say, you know what? I want Lachie Tosse out there. All right. He's a developmental player. I had Griffin address the whole speed at center thing. Do you understand the philosophy of having a center who's a little smaller? By the way, he's 6'2", 302. So Jordan Meredith isn't, you know, 240 pounds. It's not 1978.
Right.
What is their approach on maybe being a little more athletic at center?
Well, they want it's not so much being athletic so much as being versatile.
Okay.
And this is something that we saw, and I talked with Lincoln Kennedy about this early in the offseason, was he was actually seeing different concepts running in the same offensive line. That is, I'm like, okay, you talk a lot about, okay, is it a power scheme? Is it a zone scheme? Lincoln said he was seeing multiple things happening at the same time. Oh, zone blocking on the inside, power on the outside. Zone on the outside, power on the inside. So what that tells me is that you need guys that can do multiple things at the same time, if that makes sense, from an offensive lineman's perspective. You got to be pretty brilliant to be a center anyways. You're basically the brain of the entire offense. I know the quarterback is, you know, the most important position in all of team sports, but if you don't know what happened, if you're the center, you don't know what's happening. We saw what happened to the Raiders in the Super Bowl that Lincoln played in back in 2003. So to me, it's not about having a speed guy or a power guy. It's about having a versatile guy that can control and make all those calls and all those checks that are out there.
Right now, let's give away two tickets for the Front Row Card Show. It's coming up this weekend at the Rio. 550 tables of cards, comics, and collectibles. You can grab your tickets at frontrowcardshow.com. Two tickets right now, 364-1100, 364-1100. On the way back, a little more on Raiders preseason game number one. We'll look ahead to preseason game number two, and we definitely have to concentrate on the Dante Thornton underthrow.
Now back to Cofield and Company on ESPN Las Vegas.
Talking Raiders in this 5 o'clock hour. Paul Gutierrez, nice enough to join us. Hey, Paul, I listened to your podcast today with Lincoln. Tell people about that and where to find it.
Yeah, thank you for listening.
That was good. It was really good.
Yeah, it was fun. I want to make it as conversational as possible. I've basically taken over Upon Further Review, which was helmed by the great Eddie Pascal for many, many years. So to be able to jump in his shoes and try to put my own kind of little personal spin on it, that's what we're working on. But to talk, it's going to go weekly on Raiders.com, called Upon Further Review. And the first week I had Jason Horowitz, the voice of the Raiders, on. We talked about his path to get there and then how he sees a football game. And last week we did it with Lincoln Kennedy. And it was kind of, again, breaking down what we had just seen the night prior in Seattle and what to expect more. And it's great when you get a former player on there because they see it differently. And, you know, Lincoln is a phenomenal analyst in terms of breaking games down and things like that. So to go to see it through his eyes and his mind is a treat, and hopefully that's what fans get when they plug in and log on to Raiders.com to listen to Upon Further Review.
How far back do you go with Lincoln?
Lincoln and I did a book together, and it's technically Lincoln's book. But I got to write it with him and kind of tell my own story about how long I've been covering the Raiders. So that book came out in 2021. And there's a lot of good stuff in there. It's his personal journey, kind of my personal journey in terms of how I cut my journalistic teeth covering the Raiders when they were in L.A. and I was in junior college at Barstow. And, and now working for the team, it's kind of a full circle moment. So Lincoln and I never covered him when he played. But the strange thing is this. He and I graduated high school the same year. I'm Barstow High, 1988. He's Morse High down in San Diego, class of 1988. And I'm just thinking, man, I'm really glad that Barstow High never played Morse in football because I played some defensive end. I wouldn't want to have to try to pass rush against him. But we're also both kind of band studs. I say band stud, not band geeks, because we both played trumpet. And we were both like standout trumpet players in our high school band. And that's how he got discovered. He didn't play high school football until he was a sophomore, I believe, because he was out there playing in the high school band. And the football coach saw him and said, hey, how big are you? How much do you weigh? Okay. Now, so that was Lincoln's tale, and the book is still out there, and it's a lot of fun to kind of dive in there.
It's kind of an upset. I feel like most big fellas I see with the sousaphone, you know, some
the tuba
or the
bass drum.
Yeah, there was
no,
kid
he was a trumpet player.
Yeah, I was gonna say there was a kid at San Jose State about 5 years ago, and he was a big fella, and I was like, I cannot believe what an athlete this guy is. He should have been on the football team in high school. Griffin gave a look when you said 1988. Now, I smiled, because that's also my graduation year. Griffin was like, what the? Yes, Griffin.
Yeah, it was a minute ago, and that's actually the year that I covered my first ever Raider game on a credential.
Oh, wow.
December of 88, it was a winner-take-all game between the Seattle Seahawks, who were then in the AFC West, it was Mike Shanahan, who was then the Raiders coach.
Oh, wow.
And it was a shootout, 43-37, Seahawks won the AFC West with a record of 9-7, I believe. If the Raiders had won that game, they would have been 8-8, but they would have won the division based on tiebreakers. But it was the last game of Matt Millen as a Raider, last game of Todd Christensen as a Raider. And that's literally where the first Raider game I ever covered was at the LA Coliseum in December of 1988. So aging bulls, I think, is what you call this.
Yes. I heard Matt Millen on the radio broadcast. He did a good job. He still got it.
Yeah, Matt, again, I sit there and I watch him. He's just like this genteel, just very gentle kind of a giant. I'm thinking, that's not the dude I grew up watching play middle linebacker, especially when he socked up the Patriots GM. Yeah. My whole story, I want to get to the bottom of this. Maybe I'll get one of those guys on the podcast one day, is when that all went down, Matt punched out the Patriots GM after the upset playoff loss in the 85 season, so January of 86. He's coming to Howie Long's defense as if Howie Long needed help.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, I know he wasn't suited up because he was injured. Where was Lyle Alzado in all of this? That's what I want to know, because they'd probably still be trying to pull people off if Lyle.
Right. Griffin gave us a look again on the punch. Look it up. Look up.
Punching Matt, a general manager?
Look up Matt Millen punch. I mean, whoever caught the photo, it is just the follow through perfectly. Yeah, he freaking decked him.
And to localize it, Steve, this was 4 years before Moses Scurry got Conn Smith at UNLV Utah State. So there you go.
Paul Gutierrez, Cofield. Well, I want, going back to your comments about Lincoln doing the podcast, you guys have a good chemistry. I'll do the cheesy segue regardless. The chemistry needs to build with the quarterbacks, with Dante Thornton, because he's going to be a guy who gets open. What did you see? What did the team say about the AOC throw to Thornton? Because there's a lot of positives there, because he was wide open, but he also got to deliver the ball.
So I'll take the flip side of that. After the game, I'm driving in a car back to the hotel with Jason Horowitz, Kirk Morrison, and the Hall of Famer Eric Allen. And he describes the play like this. He says, look, man, as a cornerback, when you get beat that bad, all you can hope for is an underthrow and pray for that. And that's exactly what the Seahawks cornerback got, because he was 5 yards beyond him. So the fact that what I heard is that because Aiden was rolling out, and that's not his strong suit, he just didn't get enough oomph on the ball. If he has enough oomph on that and the ball gets beyond, I mean, that's a touchdown all day long. And that's why Thornton is actually, and I don't want to speak for him, but I know that Mark Davis is very, very intrigued and might be actually his favorite draft pick because of the combination of size and speed.
Yeah.
It's not just the fastest player anymore, like Al Davis would always go and, fastest guy, draft him, whatever position. No, this is something that the Raiders have needed in terms of, it's in the DNA, the vertical game. Cliff Branch, speedy guys that can run down the field, James Jett. But Thornton is so raw. They really like a lot of things about him. And when he spoke to us earlier in training camp, I asked him, what is the part of the game that you really want to show fans more of? And he said, people think that I'm just a fast guy. I like to run routes. I can run routes. I can run patterns. And I want to prove to people that I can do that. And yet, if you're going to put the fear of God into secondaries, especially the safeties, that's what he should be doing, because all that's going to do is open. It's going to clear out underneath, and it's going to open up more opportunities for the likes of Jacoby Myers and Brock Bowers and Michael Mayer.
He is listed as one of the ones at wide receiver.
Yeah.
Is there a possibility that Thornton and Porter, who were drafted as kind of raw projects, could both be starting in the first game of the regular season?
Absolutely, there's a chance for that, because as Pete Carroll, and I'm not saying that that's going to happen, but I will quote Pete Carroll when he says he doesn't care what year you are in the league. He doesn't care. You could be a veteran, you could be a rookie, you could be an undrafted rookie. If you deserve to be out there and if you bring something to the team, yeah. And you saw that. Both of those guys actually did start in that game, if I'm not mistaken. And again, small sample size, first ever exhibition for a brand new program. We'll see what happens this week, mostly in the joint practices, because I believe there's going to be more one-on-one kind of thing there if the 49ers are not so banged up that they actually let their starters play or practice, than in the game, the exhibition on Saturday, and then the exhibition the following week at Arizona. But yeah, there's a very good chance that both of those guys can do it. And especially what's intriguing to me on the cornerback side with what's going on over there is that he fits the profile of an old Legion of Boom kind of a guy. He looks like Richard Sherman out there in his uniform, a little bit skinnier, but he's a lot younger, obviously. But there's something in the profile there, which is why the trade that they made all the sense in the world, because they needed Jacorian Bennett didn't necessarily fit that profile of the big, rangy, strong, fast cornerback. Good cornerback, obviously. He started some games for them, but they also needed a defensive tackle. So it made all the sense in the world. If Jacorian wasn't going to really fit that profile, go get a defensive tackle, and here we are.
Paul Gutierrez up on Cofield and Company. You started to have a brief discussion on the podcast with Lincoln. He shut you down. I don't think he should have. On Cam Miller. About Cam Miller potentially being the two. Now, I don't think he'll be the two, but I think if he plays well enough, he gives them food for thought. And with that, if AOC does not play well, I don't think this organization has to be married to AOC. It's not this regime's guy. Now, that said, I think they would have to go out and get an experienced backup. Now, I think there's going to be some of them out there. I don't know if the organization has any thoughts on, like, Kenny Pickett, but I think Pickett will be available. There's going to be some other guys available. So I think the two is in play. It just may not be Cam Miller who goes right to the two.
Yeah, and again, you got to remember, Cam Miller was playing against guys that probably won't be on a roster in 3 weeks anyways. So that's where he was having his success against.
Yeah.
AOC, you know, he has a body of work. You can judge him. There's not a lot figuring out who he is, a lot of diagnosing what he can or can't do. That's all on tape. You see that. Yeah. He's already started a handful of games in the NFL. What this new regime wants to see is how does he then fit into this scheme. And what, again, part of the production meeting before the game, which was real interesting and intriguing, was getting to sit with Geno, but also sitting with Chip Kelly. And one of the things that has really just kind of blown my mind, and it makes all the sense in the world, is to actually hear an accomplished OC say, yeah, you always have to adapt your schemes to the personnel. Usually it's the other way around. A couple coaches ago, it wasn't that way. He was trying to make the personnel adapt to his schemes, and it didn't work. So when it comes to Aiden being the number two, he doesn't really have a lot to prove. It's his job really to lose. And after that first half, it was like, what's going on here? But Cam Miller, there's something exciting about him. And he looks like that pump fake that he threw. I mean, he looked just like Rich Gannon with that pump. I'm not saying he was Rich Gannon, who was there at the game in the booth, but that pump fake was just a thing of beauty. Granted, against guys that aren't going to be in the NFL, but it was pretty, and that's what you're looking for. You're looking for skill set kind of things.
One of the guys who got to showcase himself late was Dylan Laube. I don't think he's going to make the team just because he's a running back. He's got to be good on special teams, right?
That's where he's going to make the team. That's where he has to make the team. That's why, as good of a game as he had and as exciting as he was, the thing that probably sticks out the most is the I got it, you take it with Tommy Mellott on the punt return. Because that's where he's going to have to make his bones, is on special teams. And I do know that they really, obviously you've got Ashton Gentry as your starting running back. You've got the veteran, Raheem Mostert. They really, really love Zamir a lot. They like him a lot. And yeah, they like him a lot. Plus, he's returning kickoffs. So they love him a lot. I'm not in the business of saying, veterans that should be cut or be, that are cut candidates or anything like that. But if Laube was to make the roster, then who probably doesn't? You're probably looking at the veteran Mostert then. But he's a touchdown. He's a scoring machine, and we've seen that over the years. So Laube's got to make his bones on special teams. And, the guy, he's a pleasure to talk to anyway.
Paul, sit tight. We'll come back with Paul Gutierrez, close out Cofield and Company. We talked about someone taking strays earlier in the hour, and that was one Jamarcus Russell because of that Geno sign that Geno got pissed off at in Seattle. I don't know what's going on. I don't know who set him up, if he misspoke, but someone was freaking firing left and right at Devin White. Poor Devin White.
Cofield and Company presents Grab Bag on ESPN Las Vegas.
Stick your hand in there, dude.
Was just looking at week zero, college football. UNLV's playing in the opener against Idaho State. That was the game that was moved up from September 13th. They get out of the way for the big boxing match. 25.5 point spread. 25.5 is the point spread on that one. Also looking at some other moves. Hawaii, week zero, has gone from a 2.5 point dog to a -2 dog against Stanford. That's kind of unheard of that they'd be favored against the Stanford, but Hawaii's got a good shot in that game, especially with a local star at quarterback out of Bishop Gorman. So Micah Alihato was pretty spectacular last year in a couple of spots. I wanted to mention UNLV with you, Paul. Of course, you went to school there, but also I never got your thoughts on Stacey Ogman being brought back into the fold.
Huge, because that was one of the things. I did a story. We talked about it back in April and May last time I was on, about how the new staff coming in really wanted to reach out. Josh wanted to reach out to the old school guys, and the old school guys were kind of taking a wait and see approach. So the fact that Stacy said, yeah, I'll come on board. And Stacy, again, remember, wanted to be the head coach a couple of different times and never even got an interview. He did get an interview this time around, and the fact that he's willing to come back in an ambassador role is huge to do something for the healing that needs to happen between the really old school fans and the fans that don't have any idea about what a powerhouse UNLV used to be on a national level. So it's a really good deal. And the fact that Stacey Ogman is a Raider season ticket holder and a longtime member of Raider Nation, that's just make the semblance come together. Yeah.
Well, they needed to mend some fences there, so that's a good move. And like you said, it was pretty bitter when the split happened in the past. Back in the back.
Stick your hand in there, Dave.
You've been writing some college basketball. What's your latest story on?
Yeah, latest for Hoops HQ, my guy Seth Davis. Again, he went to Duke, but that's not really his fault. But we worked together at Sports Illustrated back in the day. Started his own website, so I've been able to do some pieces for him. The most recent, sticking with the Mountain West, looking at New Mexico. And New Mexico is basically an expansion team. And it's weird because I try and remember a basketball team that won its league and the next season does not return a single player, does not return a single coach. As Eric Olin, who got the job and was up, his name was mentioned for UNLV, as he told me, he said, the only person returning from last year's team is the strength trainer or the team manager, something like that. So it's real intriguing what's going on in Albuquerque. Plus, they're sticking around in the Mountain West with UNLV when all these other schools hightail it for the Pac-2 or the Pac-12, whatever they're going to call themselves going forward. So it was a really nice little deep dive. It's on Hoops HQ. Eric Olin was a very great interview. Talked to him a little bit about what he's facing.
What did you think of his personality?
Great guy. And again, just talked to him on the phone for about 15, 20 minutes or so, but did not seem burdened by what was going on and everything that he was doing. As a matter of fact, he welcomed the challenge. He said it was definitely different because he had been in one place for 20 years at UC San Diego, whether he was on the staff or as the head coach for a decade plus. So this was the first time that he had gone anywhere else. And not only that, but he had to build a team from scratch. So he's got a couple of guys from UC San Diego that transferred in with him. But we'll see exactly what they do. And it's one of those games that it's always going to be a rivalry for UNLV. So we'll see how fast that his style adapts to whatever he's able to bring in there.
Stick your hand in there, Dave.
Well, I mentioned before the break that Devin White was taking strays. This is a weird one. I got to watch this. I'm just reading quotes from it, so I got to see what the tone of the podcast was. But Jason Licht, I guess earlier this year, said that he shies away from drafting guys who are D-bags. Ooh. He told Dan Pompey of The Athletic that knowing what I know now, Devin White would have been off my board. He was the fifth pick in the draft. It was too much about him. I mean, what's the organization wrap so far, the impression of Devin White with the Raiders?
Great guy. They like everything about him. I mean, it's interesting. It's again, the Raiders are this haven for lost football souls, right? I mean, you go as far back as you can about it. And in talking with Devin, this is a guy that, again, is appreciating his station in life. He likes where he is. And you know, he's gone through a lot of personal tragedy in his life too, that makes him realize that exactly where he is, the station in life. So he's out there, he's starting. He had some fast speed, direct line speed, left some things to be imagined in coverage. So we'll see exactly where they go, but they really do like him in that.
Last 20 seconds, they inked Terrell Edmunds, right? Raiders are going to take a look at him.
Sure, absolutely. And why not? I mean, if you can bring in quality players, and this is what you talked about earlier, they're mining different places for guys that may have had a bigger name somewhere and shown some flashes, just hoping they can kind of rejuvenate themselves with the Raiders. And if you get a good player out of it on the cheap, all the better.
Paul, great job. We'll talk to you soon, okay?
Sounds good, man. Thanks for having me.
There he is. Paul H. Gutierrez up on Twitter. He's writing for Raiders.com, and you heard he's still writing college basketball. So check out his work, and he'll be a regular on Cofield & Company moving forward throughout the football season. Tomorrow, we We'll be working with our pals at Battleborn Injury Lawyers rest of the week, Thursday at Circa, and Friday we close it out at Treasure Island. Have a good Tuesday night. We'll see you.